a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
No, and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer. So today we're talking about the Moonstone, the second part. But
part
before
two.
before we get too deep into that, I think we have a sponsor.
We do. We have an awesome sponsor. Today's sponsor is our very own wonderful Carolyn Daughters, who runs a brand building and communications consultancy. She leads brand therapy sessions, teaches marketing courses for startups and small businesses, and leads day-long persuasive writing workshops. Carolyn and her small team empower startups, small businesses, enterprise, and government agencies to win hearts, minds, deals, and dollars. You can learn more at www.carolindaughters.com.
That was amazing.
Check it out. She sounds, is amazing.
She sounds awesome.
And beautiful. Intelligent.
She's the full package. She sounds really like the real deal.
She is, folks. CarolynDaughters.com.
So we also this month have or this podcast episode have a listener of the month. Guess we're doing listener of the month, or maybe listener of the episode,
listener of whatever increment we decide.
Sometimes we have two episodes in a month.
That's
so
true.
Let's say the listener of the episode, and that is Sherry O'Neill. Sherry, possible Poisson, because we want to use a really fun accent. Sherry Poisson O'Neill. Not sure how she pronounces that, but she has had very kind things to say about Tea Tonic and Toxin, and she's given the podcast a listen and a thumbs up. So thank you, Sherry. We are going to find your address and send you one of these amazing stickers that we've created.
Yeah, Sherry, look for a message on social media where we'll be asking you where we can send your sticker. Yeah. And speaking of stickers, folks, just put this out there. I think we want to make maybe some limited edition stickers. Mm-hmm. I know that we're always featuring some cool vintage artwork from our books. So look for some vintage artwork stickers, possibly some voting opportunities to get your input on what you'd like to see in a sticker.
Love it. And Sarah is having a great time creating these stickers.
I'm obsessed with stickers.
She's I wasn't going to go there. I was trying to downplay it. Like, she really enjoys it. It's
no,
kind of
man.
Fun. No, she is. She's actually obsessed.
The first place that sticker's going to go is my cooler, where all my stickers go.
Excellent. Excellent. Very good.
All right. So we're reading the second part of the Moonstone today, entitled The Discovery of Truth. Right. In London, Godfrey and a moneylender named Mr. Lucre are attacked and searched. Lady Verinder dies, and Rachel reluctantly agrees to marry Godfrey. She breaks off the engagement when Mr. Bruff, the family lawyer, tells her that Godfrey is only marrying her for her money. By the way, if you didn't know that these podcasts episodes are full of spoilers, let me tell you that now. So if you haven't read the book and you want to read it, we're going to tell you the endings now. So, meanwhile, Franklin is determined to restore Rachel's good opinion. He returns to Yorkshire, where a friend of Rosanna Spearman gives him a letter she wrote. The letter leads him to the Shivering Sands, where Rosanna died. There, Rosanna had hidden his nightgown, which is smeared with paint, along with a confession that she hid the nightgown and killed herself out of love for him. Confused, Franklin meets with Rachel in London. She says she saw him take the diamond. She has kept quiet to protect his reputation. Mm. Next, Franklin meets the doctor's assistant, Ezra Jennings. Ezra tells Franklin that the doctor secretly gave Franklin opium the night the Moonstone was stolen. Under the influence of opium, Franklin took the diamond to keep it safe. Jennings suggests that if Franklin takes opium again under similar conditions, he may reveal where the diamond is hidden. They conduct the experiment. Franklin takes a substitute gem, but doesn't reveal the Moonstone's hiding place. Rachel forgives him and they confess their love for each other. Mm. In the meantime, the family lawyer, Mr. Bruff, has Mr. Luker's bank watched. The moneylender is seen passing the moonstone to a sailor. Later that same night, the sailor is murdered at a dockside inn. Sergeant Cuff reveals that the sailor was...
Dun, dun, dun.
Godfrey! In disguise! Godfrey was the real thief, and he was killed by the three Brahmins who have now recovered the diamond. Mm-hmm. The story ends with Mr. Murthwaite, a famous global traveler, who witnesses a religious ceremony in India, where the Brahmins return the diamond to the forehead of the god of the moon. There you have it, folks. It's a really cool twist.
Really cool twist. Hopefully you've read the book, loved the book. If you didn't love the book, we also want to hear why. We'd love to hear any of your thoughts about this book.
Tell us what you didn't love about the book.
Yeah, we encourage that at tetonicandtoxin.com. We have several opportunities on the site for you to share your thoughts. We're also on Instagram and Facebook at Tetonic and Toxin. Share any thought you have about the books we've chosen. We chose great books. We chose problematic books. You have no idea why we chose one book or another. Or you just want to weigh in on your thoughts after you've read the book. What are you thinking?
Yeah. All thoughts welcome. Mm-hmm. And you may get a sticker if you share them.
And
I know that would motivate me.
Yes. Yes. So if any of you are looking to market to Sarah, really offering a sticker would help.
Yeah, definitely helps.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In advance for your stickers.
So, Sarah, let's talk. We've been talking about Gabriel Betteredge in part one. We have one other podcast devoted to the Moonstone. Mm-hmm. Such a big, interesting book. We've got two episodes. So let's talk about some of the characters who think that they're maybe superior to reason.
I like this too because Gabriel and Miss Clack did not like each other. Mm-hmm. They're pretty open about disliking each other. Mm-hmm. But they both have this idea that they're superior to reason. So Gabriel brings it up several times. Mm-hmm. And he's superior to reason because he feels like he knows the family mm-hmm. and he loves them.
Yeah.
So whatever reason you're reasoning, he knows better. And Miss Clack is superior to reason, primarily on religious grounds. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, the statement itself is a little bit ridiculous today. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, I don't know. I wondered if maybe they have a little bit of merit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well... So each is showing devotion to something, whether it's the family Gabriel supporting, the Verinder family, or Miss Clack, it's, she has religion on her side or thinks that she does. So that's sort of, their compass or their baseline, what's possible, what could have happened, what could not have happened. And they really have, each of them, a great deal of respect for their own compass or their mm-hmm. own ability to see the world clearly.
Well, and I guess because it came to my mind that's ridiculous, superior to reason. But then in the end, they each turn out to be right
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you have to think about, how did they turn out to be right if reason wasn't on their side? But I think sometimes it can be tempting to think about reason mm-hmm. as maybe a static thing when it's largely, and you can see happens in the Moonstone, it's very circumstantial,
mm-hmm.
right? So circumstances point to Rachel's, has the Moonstone is hiding it. That's what Sergeant Cuff thought.
Yeah.
I mean, while Sergeant Cuff is right in many ways about many things.
You got that one wrong.
Yeah, he was wrong about Rachel, and Gabriel knew he was wrong about Rachel because, as he says, he's superior to reason, but we can also, I think about it in terms of he has access to different information
mm-hmm.
about, character,
mm-hmm.
which maybe isn't opposed to reason. And when you think about reason as, sort of the best circumstantial explanation,
right,
there's maybe always room for a little more information.
Right. So he's able to sort of complicate this situation by saying, I actually know the people involved. So I know what I have information the police don't have because they're coming in here cold. They don't know anyone. But then you get into, you hear a crime is committed, in real day-to-day life, a crime is committed, and the family of whoever committed the crime says, oh, my father, brother, sister, daughter could never have done.
Yeah.
You know, I know them. Oh, I know that's not, they could never have. And so that reason is potentially fallible.
It is, yeah. I would offer that maybe a real legitimate deep knowledge of someone's character mm-hmm. is itself a piece of evidence mm-hmm. worth considering
yeah.
when you're putting all the pieces together in here.
Yeah.
Gabriel turns out to be right. I can't exactly remember the circumstances under which Clack said it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking it might have been kind of the stupid doctor's orders where mm-hmm. like, oh, you're dying.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Verinder, best not think of anything serious.
Yes.
Please only read frivolous nonsense.
Yes.
Keep
your brain light and free and don't yeah. put anything in it to complicate anything or muddy your thoughts.
Ooh, and when Clack comes in, she's like, well, I'm superior to reason. I want her to think more transcendent thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I'm a little bit on Clack's side there.
Yeah.
Like, that's just because the doctor says it, in hindsight.
Right.
We know that that's kind of nonsense. Like, you right. don't have to just read frivolous books because you're terminal. And maybe that's a really good time to think about your life more deeply.
Sure. Yeah. And, we don't know if the doctor would give that advice similarly to a man. We don't have.
Yeah, there's that.
We don't. We don't know. He might. We don't know. But we know that Lady Verinder is considered, fragile enough that no thought should complicate her life right now. It should all, like, if she were living today, she'd be watching soap operas and,
Yeah. I really felt honestly in that too, like, for the poor people at the time that didn't have the luxury of just being frivolous in their brains.
Yes.
They just had to die. Sorry.
Yeah.
Go forth, work your day to day, die.
Yeah. Now, so Miss Clack, has these delightful insights at times that, if you just write her off as this sanctimonious busybody, she's just, posing as this, religious figure who is supporting charities and holier than thou. But, in reality, you pull back the veil. If you just write her off there, you might not see that she has some, like, seriously legit points of view. Tell me what you think about Miss Clack, who in many scenes comes across as really quite, silly.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, that's one of the things that always gets me is like, mm-hmm. how is she being presented? What is the perspective the narrator wants us to take away? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't always feel genuine to me.
Yeah.
We know from many sources, again, including Dickens,
mm-hmm.
that times were rough on the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And here's, like, poor Clack, the only one who is herself poor.
Yeah.
Her relatives, they're her first cousins.
Mm-hmm.
They're not helping her at all. They would think it's absurd that they should.
Right.
The most they'll help her is, like, come over for dinner and then be we'll resentful feed you of
on
her.
Saturday, so come over.
Yeah. Yet they ask her to do this work for them that they're mm-hmm. incapable of doing because mm-hmm. of their frivolousness.
Mm-hmm.
So she's out there actually participating in charities. And the charities, the way Wilkie writes them, they do sound absurd. Mm-hmm. Like the underwear society, basically, where they take...
Yes.
I think I understood it, that they take, like, sort of drunk, neglectful father's mm-hmm. pants and make them smaller for their children to have underwear.
Something like
that's
that.
What it's, it was a very strange society, and maybe... Maybe London life was full of all these bizarre charities, but sure.
Misguided attempts.
Yeah.
Maybe heartfelt. We don't know, but misguided nonetheless attempts to help people.
We are still full of misguided charitable attempts in 2022.
Yeah.
So it's.
So the family that, she's Miss Clack is poor. The family that invites her periodically over for Saturday dinner or what have you. That family, they're just living off of wealth. They are arguably quite lazy and somewhat absurd. Let's spend our next several days, painting this door and then figuring out what dress to wear for dinner.
Yeah, let's go to the opera. Oh, no, we can't go to the opera. It's almost unarguably.
Yeah, okay. So
frivolous. Yes. So they're not they're thinking frivolous. About anything, and they're like looking down on everyone that participates in the charities.
And they're not working for their wealth. They have this inherited wealth. So I don't know. I would argue maybe they should be giving a little bit of it to some family members like Miss Clack. Why not? It's not as if they, you know, morning, noon, and night have been working to earn it, and therefore they have, you know, great stakes. You know, it's just money that they have that allows them to live frivolous lives.
Absolutely. And even Lady Verinder was saying, like they read the will and they ask Clack to witness it, and she didn't get a thing out of the will. Mm-hmm. And Lady Verinder's like, oh, I hope you're not offended. I'm going to give you your legacy myself. Mm-hmm. And then she dies. She dies. Clack gets nothing. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence whatsoever that she is dishonest in anything she says or does.
Yeah. Miss Clack.
Right.
Yeah.
But still, nobody takes it upon themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To give her anything. And then they actually just kind of estrange her when they find out she was trying to... I'm not exactly sure what she was trying to do with Lady Verinder by pushing the tracks, other than just trying to get her to think more deeply or participate in a charity.
It's
or
possible she really wanted her to have sort of a religious awakening.
It seems like it.
Yeah, it felt, you know, it felt like that's what she was actually attempting to do. We may or may not like what she was attempting to do, but it didn't feel false to me.
No, and Rachel's so upset at the implication that her mother would even need a religious awakening that she, like, disowns Clack forever and gives her nothing.
Right.
She's like, okay.
Right.
That's... Maybe you need a religious awakening after all.
Right. Maybe Miss Clack needed somebody, a random relative who steals international jewels to bequeath a jewel to her.
Exactly.
Like, we should all maybe be so fortunate as to have our thieving uncle bequeath us a jewel from India.
Not necessarily untrue anything she says. I do think she was a little self-deceived, and some, at least it came across in the nature of her relationship to Godfrey.
Yeah,
it seemed really clear to me that she was in love with Godfrey, that she would just like kind of randomly talk about like his beautiful hair and his like speaking voice and this and that, and
she liked that he was involved in the charitable organizations.
She thought he was a really supported. She kept calling him our Christian hero, which was very funny, especially since he was made out to be like the deepest hypocrite and villain in the book.
Yes, which as a reader for me became evident fairly early on, but not immediately by any stretch, but fairly early on. And then, of course, he's unmasked at the end of the book, literally unmasked. Yes. He was disguised as a sailor and is killed at the end of the book.
Yeah. Well, but to me, that maybe I'm just being like too sympathetic to Clack. I don't know. But I was like, I have trouble holding that against her, though, because who hasn't deceived themselves about their own motivations? I don't know.
She's also given space in the book, much like Rosanna Spearman, to feel attraction for a man.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in most books of this period, particularly, but a lot of books generally, the guy is given all the liberty in the world to feel attraction for someone, to pursue this woman, to, you know, want to court her, to want to marry her. You don't always see a woman expressing attraction the other direction and having any agency there or attempted agency there.
You know, that's extremely true. I think that's a really good point. In a lot of the historical books that we've read prior to this, you know, and in other settings, you know, outside of this particular genre list, I was always astounded that the position of the women so often seemed to be like obliviousness.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I had no feelings until he was in love with me. And then it awakened something.
Yes.
And I was like, wait, what?
Yes.
Okay, weird.
So what did it awaken? Did it awaken a sense of security? Like, thank goodness now I have a situation where I'll be taken care of through the rest of my life. It's like Godfrey proposes to Rachel at one point, right? And it's like the least romantic proposal in the history of proposals.
Get used to me.
Yeah, I'm fine. It'll be fine. And he says to her, "Do you know many wives who respect and admire their husbands? And yet they and their husbands get on very well. How many brides go to the altar with hearts that would bear inspection by the men who take them there? And yet it doesn't end unhappily. Somehow or other, the nuptial establishment jogs on. The truth is, women try marriage as a refuge far more numerously than they're willing to admit. And they find that marriage has justified their confidence in it."
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting, too, and it's parallel to the proposal in The Woman in White, where the villain, again, makes a really similar proposal. Yeah.
It'll be fine.
She tells him, like, "I love someone else. You know, if you take me on, just know that I love someone else." And he's like, well, you know, respect is more than I'd even just be happy with. You can build a marriage on that. You'll get used to each other.
It does
seem bizarre, I think, to our ears, and yet I also have several friends from arranged marriages, where it does start off with kind of like this, well, this feels like a good match.
Yeah.
You know, these are a little different because they have kind of some negative things towards them. They start out with the woman's in love with someone else.
Yeah.
And the man proposes that you'll grow to like me. I promise.
But both men also share a particular trait. They're both trying to marry for money.
Yes.
They're both trying to get the woman's money.
So what is that? Is there any reason why Wilkie chose that for kind of the both villains in these two books? Mm. Or do you think it was common at the time? Because he really dwells a lot on detailing out the particulars of the financial endowments on the women.
Yeah, he's super interested in that.
And then that's then the motivation for these villainous acts.
But maybe part of the villainy is this, you know, sales pitch, this used car salesman pitch that they deliver, which is like, "To know me is to love me. It'll work out. Everything's fine." Like, you know, "Oh, cool. Well, as long as everything will be fine, then let's sign
you got to marry somebody, right?
Yeah, and I'm as good as anyone, and hey, I'm right here, and I'm asking." Like, okay. So maybe that's part of the villainy, is the deception of this kind of speech where, you know, really, like, back in the 19th century, you know, and earlier, not everybody was marrying for love. It wasn't some sort of fairy tale. No. Like, "I saw him from across the room as I was working my 14 to 16 hour dishwashing day 7 days a week. And I decided, my gosh, we have to be, you know," like that sort of fairy tale thing was not the real deal necessarily. You know, it is in a Jane Austen novel.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the engagements do seem to happen fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Even when they are for love. So you kind of wonder, like, is it though? Is it?
Right. Or do they have to get engaged quickly enough that the one doesn't find out the other is like the worst match ever? You know, because you got to get to know someone. So, like, well, to know me is to love me for the first month. But boy, month two onward is going to be a nightmare, as was the case in Woman in White.
Yeah.
So it's like, I seem charming on the surface. So let's ride that out real quick. Like, let's get married right now.
Yeah, it just makes me really wonder, like, maybe this was the subject of news at the time or something like that.
Yeah.
That a lot of these matches were winding up in murderous, villainous deeds. I don't know. Or maybe it was just a good opportunity for a story.
I think it probably for a story. But, you know, any of you listening, those of you who love Wilkie Collins, who really know the, 1860s, for example, 1850s through end of the century, can help fill us in on, like, this seems to be a theme with Wilkie Collins. So what's his deal? Like, so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that said, I think the argument often was working in these situations because it's not wholly without merit. I mean, it is ridiculous and villainous in these situations, but
sure.
In a large extent, marriage is very much kind of a logistical partnership. And that's a super important component, mm-hmm. that if you can get it right, it goes a really long way.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Godfrey turned out to be a, you know, terrible guy.
But yeah.
At this point, when he's, you know, asking for a hand in marriage, he seems like a, you know, okay guy. Like, he doesn't seem like the worst match in the world. But yeah, it was a fairly unromantic proposal as far as, you know, as proposals go. So if you're looking for that for your template for your own future proposal, I would suggest looking elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, so far we're like 1 and 2. It worked in the first book and not the second.
Yeah, so, yeah. And so, you know, Rachel, she's sort of a conventional character, I'm going to argue. Franklin Blake is sort of a conventional hero, sort of a heart right from Woman in White. And Wilkie Collins really seems to identify with these conventional hero types, but he also, it's kind of interesting, but he also sympathizes with outsiders. I felt Ezra Jennings, Rosanna, even the three Brahmins who are searching for this moonstone, like, I feel like there's this really interesting affection he has for them. What did you think about that?
I agree with what you're saying, that it's interesting that he brings them into the story. Mm-hmm. I do feel like, you know, he does give them a voice, but ultimately I felt like they were treated fairly callously. Mm. And treated callously oftentimes by his hero. Okay. So that's where I'm kind of wondering. I'm like, is this like a commentary on how callously we treat people? Or is Wilkie just kind of thinking about them as almost like sideshow characters? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you'll see people in modern day be like, oh, I have all this sympathy for these outcast outsiders who need their rights. But, well, no, I don't actually know any. None of them are my actual friends.
Sure. I've never met anyone.
I just share their posts on Instagram or something like that. Yeah. So yeah, you know, I don't know. I couldn't figure Wilkie out here. Like, I love the Rosanna Spearman character. But the way that her suicide, the only one that really seemed deeply sympathetic was Betteredge.
Yeah.
His hero kind of caused it.
Yeah.
And then didn't feel really bad enough about it,
in my opinion. Yeah, he seemed to really gloss over
it. Well, it wasn't my fault, though. Eh. Moving on.
Yeah.
I don't want to think those unpleasant thoughts. And kind of the same thing, we talked about Gooseberry. You know, poor Gooseberry is clearly like a street urchin who's mm-hmm. getting like tuppence on the side for running around doing work for this lawyer.
Yeah.
Dickens would have treated him with like deep empathy and dignity. Whereas here, he's just a little comedic and then goes about his way with great promise to be a detective in the future.
Which I think is Wilkie Collins throwing that little modicum of respect, you know, that he has that affinity. He seems, I don't know, he straddles both worlds in my mind. Like, he seems like he hasn't either solidified his own opinion on it, or he's not committed to communicating that opinion in the book. So I don't get a real, like, clear sense of how he feels about Rosanna, Ezra Jennings, the Brahmins, Gooseberry, who's, you know, the kid, Octavius Guy, which is a very cool name, by the way. Yeah. Very cool name. So, yeah, for me, it's not clear. There's some sort of, like, authorial intention that's sort of wavering for me there.
You know, and maybe it's kind of like a man of the times. You know, the little I know of the Victorian era, they were kind of just moving out. Like, I believe that's when slavery was outlawed during that era and in Britain, and different changes were occurring. And so maybe the brain awakens to, like, you know, these are people too.
Yeah.
And I haven't fully deeply comprehended that yet, but mm-hmm. I'm on board with the concept. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe it's like he's there, but not all the way there in my
opinion. Yeah, he's sort of experimenting with, you know, these are complex. Like, for him to even show any affinity for the three Brahmins is somewhat bold at this time period.
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe if he was outright saying, like, these are the three greatest guys in the world, and I'm completely in their camp and the story is told from their point of view, like, that would be a very different story.
Yes. Yeah.
Very different. So, you know,
they don't get to narrate.
They do not get a narratorial voice in this story. But and then, you know, Franklin Blake, who I know, if you've listened to our previous podcast episode, which focuses on the first part of the Moonstone, you know that Sarah is a little annoyed by Franklin Blake.
I am.
You know, he has a big role in this book. And What annoys you about him, Sarah? Let's just stop. If our listeners haven't had a chance to listen to episode one on the Moonstone.
Well, it's largely to me just kind of how callously he comes across to mm-hmm. his own faults mm-hmm. and how easily he justifies himself. Mm. You know, there's several things he does. It comes to light that there's this big disagreement between him and the Verinders mm-hmm. because, like, a debt collector comes calling. Mm-hmm. And apparently he's borrowed a lot of money, not from his rich family, mm-hmm. but from some poor working guy
yeah.
who he's not paying back mm-hmm. and is on, like, the verge of bankruptcy. And he's just kind of, like, miffed that this is bothering him
yeah.
and that it's being held against him. And then Lady Verinder pays it off.
Yeah.
You know, in kind of the same way he treats Gooseberry. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, okay, this is super important. Come as soon as you can to my places where I'm staying. Here's my address. And Gooseberry, mm-hmm. you know, wonderful guy that he is. He does it. He goes there. He waits. Yeah. Is Franklin there on time? Not only is Franklin not there on time, he's with Rachel.
Yeah.
And he's not even apologetic. He's yeah. like, well, narrator, if you don't know why it's so hard to, like, basically, like, stop, like, mooning over my girlfriend, then you're not a person I ever want to meet. I was like, yes, Franklin, let's not meet. Because you're just letting this poor street urchin go hungry in yeah. your yeah. lobby of your apartment.
Right.
And then kind of mad that anyone should hold you accountable. That's what really gets me about Franklin.
He's thoughtless. He's callous. He's a lot yeah. of different things like this.
Rachel, man. He was so offended that Rachel would ever suspect him, even though she saw him take the diamond with her own eyes. How could she believe that of him?
Yes.
Like, still, to the end, the bitter end, he thought she was in the wrong over it. Yes.
Self-involved, yeah.
Like, they should know his character.
Mm-hmm.
You mean the character that, like, ruins the poor and, mm-hmm. like, is callous towards them?
And toward Rosanna, and, you know,
The way he treated Rosanna.
I mean,
that was awful.
She tried to hide the evidence, right? She hides the nightgown.
Yeah.
That he wore, and she ends up killing herself.
He won't so much as speak to her.
Uh-huh.
And then he says his strategy to help her is to act like he doesn't care about her at all,
mm-hmm.
which then drives her to suicide.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, well, that was my strategy, though.
Yeah, that was a great strategy.
Like, I was just trying to help.
Yeah.
She took me seriously. She shouldn't have.
He's not as sympathetic as I think he's meant to be. For me, he was not. But he does give a voice to Ezra Jennings.
Yes.
And he does seem to recognize that Ezra Jennings is getting sort of a bad rep in town simply because of how he looks.
Yes. Well, and apparently there's something mysterious in his past that we never do find out.
Right. We don't find out, but we know that, you know, there's a story of love and love lost, that there his reputation has been soiled, right or wrong. We know that people in town, he has, I believe, darker skin, and people in town seem to distrust him, and I believe he's described as swarthy.
Yeah, even better, it does not like him.
Yeah. Now, Franklin Blake does, and we learn a lot about Ezra Jennings from Franklin Blake, which for me is one of the saving graces of Franklin Blake.
Yes. Yes.
And we learn, so there's a doctor at the beginning of this story. His name is Mr. Candy, and
I love people's names in this book, by the way.
They're very nice. Better Edge.
Yeah.
Spearman, Rosanna Spearman, Mr. Clack. Candy. Miss Clack.
Mr. Candy.
And so Mr. Candy He's not a character very long because there's some illness he suffers from right after the Moonstone is stolen.
Yeah, it's like a Marion Holcomb illness. He gets in the rain for a long time and it nearly destroys him.
When I was a kid, if it was raining or snowing or whatever, my parents would say things like, well, don't go out in the rain, you'll get sick. And I don't know, like, apparently the characters in this book, like, they get rained upon and then suddenly they have like a 4-month flu or something.
Yeah. Candy is like ruined.
Yeah. For life. He's ruined. But he and early in the book, Franklin and Mr. Candy have this debate over medicine or the use of opium or something like this.
Franklin was just kind of being a jerk. Mm-hmm. As I recall at the beginning, like, medicine is stupid, mm-hmm. basically, which, whether you think medicine is stupid or not, I'm not going to have the argument with a doctor. That's just rude.
At a birthday party.
Yeah, like, I think Betteridge even recalls it as, like, who loves Franklin. It's like, oh, why are you doing that? Yeah. You're ruining the conversation here. Mm-hmm. He, like, blames it on the Moonstone's curse. Like,
I blame it on the privilege that Franklin Blake has. It's that privilege that allows him to borrow money from someone who doesn't have much money and then say, I shouldn't have to pay that back. Yeah. And it's the privilege that allows him to speak to a doctor as if he knows more than the doctor. It's, you know.
Yeah, like, what if I was talking to you, even if I thought writing was stupid, and I was like, writing's so stupid. You're just such a waste. Why would you even spend time on that?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like an obnoxious way to speak mm-hmm. to people. It's mm-hmm. unpleasant. Yeah. It's impolite.
Yes, it's all of those things. And so I think that that's born of his, you know, white male privilege, probably.
At least.
And his white male also, like, familial wealth, because he's about to inherit.
Yeah, he's going to be super rich. Yeah. That's why everyone's loaning him money to their detriment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, and let's not forget Rachel, who sees him steal the Moonstone.
Yeah.
And he's super offended that she would think he stole the Moonstone.
Right.
Still.
Right. Yeah.
Don't you know me? It's me. I'm great.
So there's a key part of the book that happens with this doctor, Mr. Candy, before he goes into his, 4-month or 4-year or whatever downfall, medical situation or illness, where he gives Franklin Blake opium without telling Franklin Blake he's giving him opium.
Yeah, and that was eye-opening for me too, because I've read in a lot of books about people taking laudanum.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know laudanum was opium. Yes. It's just like, diluted opium, and that was kind of the sleeping solution at the time. So he sneaks a little laudanum, which sounds to me less serious, because I'm like, I know all these Victorian ladies were taking laudanum,
right? So you're thinking it's like,
yeah, it's not like, give him drugs like hard opium, like, right. It would be now.
Yeah, you're thinking it's like a Sudafed or something.
Yeah, that's it's almost how I've heard it referred to in the past.
Yeah, so laudanum, opium. We're nothing but educational here at Toxin. So yeah, it's just a learning experience.
It is, and that's why I like to read these old books too. I feel like I'm always learning something interesting.
But he basically puts him into a state where he wants. So what happens is Franklin Blake wanders around in this sort of, opium stupor. He takes the Moonstone out of Rachel's room and puts it somewhere. We don't know where. And so Ezra Jennings, who's the doctor's assistant, that's his job. Mr. Candy, the doctor, is out of commission. So Ezra Jennings jumps in and says, well, every doctor in large practice finds himself every now and then obliged to deceive his patients. I don't defend the folly of playing this trick. I do plead with you for a more accurate, more merciful construction of motives. So I read this and thought, this is horrifying. Like, that a doctor could do this.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Although,
because it was a trick. It wasn't as if Franklin Blake, needed opium necessarily.
Right. Well, and I wonder too, because that's how they refer to some of the hijinks, I would say, in Notting Hill Mystery. Mm-hmm. It's like, she was just playing a trick. She put this diuretic in. they're seeing it. I wonder, you know, it's like the almost the rise of chemistry in this era. And people are kind of seeing it as like, oh, I'll just give you a little
experimental nature of it. Like not really always knowing, you know, is this right to do, wrong to do? Does it matter?
Yeah, it kind of predates, too, a lot of regulation around the field. I mean, it's certainly human motivation to be like, you jerk, I'll show you. But yeah, the idea that a doctor would intentionally trick you is very disturbing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I feel like it does happen, and I hear about it happening, that, you know, maybe the medical profession gets so specialized that there's maybe some unawareness always of what's being prescribed.
Right.
In terms of like a holistic evaluation. And so doctors do make mistakes.
Sure.
But this was definitely on purpose.
Yes. And just the most interesting part for me is this trick that he plays, that Mr. Candy, the doctor, plays. It happens and then it disappears, you know, from the story in large part until it's revealed at the end, because Mr. Candy is not a character in the book because of this illness that he has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just, you know, I keep coming back to how serious was it at the time? Mm-hmm. Like, if you were having sleeping troubles, maybe I recommend to you melatonin,
which
is largely harmless.
But you wouldn't slip me melatonin without telling me.
I wouldn't. But at the same time, I could think to myself, this is harmless. Let me just give it a try.
Yes.
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Or would I? Yeah. No, I wouldn't. But if you thought of it at kind of that level, you know, definitely a bad decision on Mr. Candy's part.
Right. But so Ezra Jennings comes up with this really interesting plan. He says, let's recreate the whole scene. So Franklin, let's give you some more opium.
Yeah. So apparently Ezra Jennings is an opium addict due to his medical condition. And, you know, he's doing all of this sort of neurology research and wants to write a book.
Yeah.
And this just fits right in with everything.
Yeah. So he says, let's recreate the scene. So this is Ezra Jennings playing detective here. So, which I think is really cool, because we have Inspector Cuff, who is the actual detective at the beginning of the book. We see him in part one, at the end of part one. Then we see him at the end of part two.
Yeah.
And then we get like Ezra Jennings trying to recreate the scene all along. We have Franklin Blake trying to investigate, you know, what happened to Rosanna, what happened to the Moonstone, trying to figure out all the details here. You know, other characters like Gabriel Betteredge, Rosanna, even the boy, right? The boy, Gooseberry. They're all like playing detective or, you know, super spy. Like they're following people. They're trying to figure stuff out. It's cool having, I think it's really cool having so many detectives.
That's true.
In one book.
It's a book of many detectives.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought that was so fun. And, you know, some of them impressed me more than others. Like Miss Clack, like, honestly, she is hiding behind a curtain or whatever. Like, that is amazing. That is amazing.
She hid behind the curtain and saw the whole proposal.
I was dying when I read this. I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever... It reminded me a little bit of in The Woman in White, Marion Halcombe is, like, outside the window, hanging on for dear life, overhearing, you know, Count Fosco's evil plans and so forth, and Sir Percival's evil plans. And... But yeah, so she's hiding back there, and I think that's so interesting. And, you know, Rosanna's covering up Franklin's crime, or what she thinks is his crime, and Ezra Jennings is recreating the crime, and, like, it's so cool having so many people. So this is the detective fever that, that Gabriel Betteredge talks about, you know?
One thing that really got me, I liked Ezra a lot, and I thought his experiment, you know, well, I'm sure it was a bit out there. I was surprised at the opposition it met with.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of just my philosophy of trying things is, well, is it weird? Maybe.
Yeah.
Will it hurt anything? No. Well, then why not?
Right.
But, like, the lawyer and Betteredge were like, this is so stupid. You should never try it. This is the dumbest thing.
Yeah.
Don't even try. And I'm like, but there's literally no drawback to trying it.
Yeah. Like, what's this opposition? But then somewhere along the way, like, you know, as night fell and, you know, Franklin's now had his opium and they start to get into it a little bit.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, okay, you know, this is interesting. And
to their credit, they're totally won over.
Yes.
But the opposition to things that are essentially harmless just makes no sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's this crime, you know, at the heart of this book, right? You know, we're introduced to it at the very beginning of the book, right? John John Herncastle,
the killer.
He kills several people. He steals this moonstone.
He gets like moonstone fever possesses him. It was very interesting.
Yeah, because he keeps this thing and hides it away throughout his life, and then
it ruins his life.
Yeah,
he gets no value from it.
Mm-hmm. He gives it to his niece. Either as a gift or as revenge.
Yeah, because he hates his sister.
Right, so it's got a curse on it, this stone.
Yeah.
And at the very beginning, there's this 1799 family paper, and John Herncastle's cousin writes, "It is my conviction or my delusion that crime brings its own fatality with it." And this same concept, and I believe even possibly that same phrasing is in The Woman in White, this idea that crime brings its own fatality. So the crime brings this curse, I guess.
Yeah, I remember that very much from The Woman in White. It was like a big discussion where the two villains really make fun of them for thinking that crime brings it. And then they're like, oh, is that something out of your little girl's copybook? And I was like, oh, is that something they like teach in school? Like the saying, crime brings its own fatality.
Yeah. And yet, you know, Sir Percival and Count Fosco come to their, you know, their end, so that, you know, they are punished in the book's own way for, I guess, for the crime, the crimes that they're committing. But Count Fosco's secret brotherhood hunt him down and make him pay. So.
Yeah. And you see it here too, I think. And it sounds absurd. It sounds stupid. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still a pretty common concept.
Yeah.
Maybe it's even a true concept.
Right.
You know, I think it's kind of related to the idea of karma. It's related, you know, to more of the biblical idea of like reaping and sowing, like what goes around comes around.
Mm-hmm. Crime doesn't pay.
Yeah, crime doesn't pay. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we think of it that way because you see sort of consequentially,
right?
People get away with stuff.
Right.
But then there's this sort of other level of like, you don't see always what they're paying, and you don't see ultimately, if you do take kind of like the religious view, the afterlife, you know, what sort of justice is meted out at the end of life, or what sort of consequences do they live with during their life? You know, Herncastle gets away with it, but he's alienated from his whole family and can never actually use the moonstone for anything because he'll get murdered as soon as it comes out.
It's kind of like,
okay,
you go into the museum and you steal the Picasso.
Yeah.
And then, you know, now it's in your home and you can never show anybody the Picasso because the moment you do that, the secret's out and you're arrested for stealing the Picasso. So now you have this Picasso and you're like, oh, it's so amazing. I wish someone could see my Picasso.
I guess ultimately I probably do subscribe to this view that even if you maybe criminally get away with it, that there are effects in your heart and in your relationship and in your mind and in the quality of the life that you lead that degrades that.
Well, and so at the end, right, you know, the Brahmins run away with this moonstone and the Inspector Cuff arrives at the end, as he did in the end of part one, and he says, there's a chance of laying hands on the Indians and of recovering the moonstone yet. Yet on the last page, the gem, the moonstone, is returned to the forehead of the god of the moon. So, like, what's your take on this ending of this book?
They're never going to get it back. It went back to where it belongs. Mm-hmm. That's my take. I like Cuff is delusional and he should drop it.
Yeah.
Like, why would you even try at that point? It wasn't yours to begin with.
Right. So it's.
Are you going to go take it back from the temple?
Because it's sort of like, it's trying to make the theft of this gem legitimate when it's not legitimate.
Yeah, that's so weird.
Yes. And so I liked that Wilkie Collins ends with the gem being returned.
Yeah. Yeah, it was almost this sort of primal justice that whatever Inspector Cuff writes, this thing is going back where it belongs. Yeah. And everybody's really happy about it.
Yeah. Recovering the Moonstone. Like, what would that mean? That, you know, it was stolen at some period of time earlier and we can still one day recover it.
Some 18-year-old British girl can wear it to the opera.
Yes. Hooray. When she's not painting her door, because she can't go to the opera on the days when she's painting her
right.
door.
Right. It's crucial.
Yeah. So I felt like it had a really pretty satisfying ending.
Yeah, I was glad that it went that direction. I was afraid that I was like, please don't recover the Moonstone. It's so much.
Yes.
It almost shouldn't be a plot line. That was like my main beef. It's like, this shouldn't be a plot line. They should just give it back now that they found it.
Yes.
Yeah. It was in hiding. And now it's here. It is.
Yes. And so I was glad, you know, because I was a little concerned, to be honest, that it was going to end by, you know, finally the Moonstone made its way back to Rachel and she and Franklin. And, you know,
yeah.
I'm so, so glad it didn't, because it easily could have.
Yes. Yeah, I was really glad as well that it went back to where it belonged. What was a little bit sad to me is I didn't quite understand, like, this deal that the Brahmins had made. Like, in order to be able to recover the Moonstone, they had to discard their status and, like, never see each other ever again and, I think, like,
part
roam
of it was
the
just
earth.
Even leaving their homes
was
forbidden. So just going in search of this Moonstone and leaving their homes and all of that.
It was still expected that they did it.
Yes. Yeah, so, but as Brahmins, they are the highest caste.
Yes.
So, but I think they did it because, you know, out of, you know, religious fealty. Like they believed that this was what they were meant to do. And they could be rewarded for that, even though on the surface they might not be rewarded for it.
Yeah, maybe it's like the next life kind of reward or something.
Yeah, I felt like it was probably a next life sort of reward.
Yeah, I thought that was a real bummer, that sort of a tragic ending for them.
Mm-hmm.
After they went to all this trouble. And I didn't feel sad at all about their murdering. I'll just say that.
Yes, they did not. They were pretty, you know, cold about that.
Well, I felt a little cold about it myself, honestly.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, maybe they didn't have to kill Godfrey, but he clearly had it coming. Oh, we didn't even talk about his whole mistress life that he had to pay for his mistress's villa.
Oh.
Like, got so into crazy debt that he stole the stupid Moonstone.
Yeah. Godfrey.
Man. What a weird character.
Yeah. Godfrey, we hardly knew ye. Yeah. And we didn't get a whole lot of his real perspective. Like, that would have been interesting to really hear Godfrey's story.
Yes.
Yes. You know, because we did hear, through letters, we did hear Rosanna's story, and I felt connected to her, and I really felt, I felt, I liked her as a character. And Ezra Jennings, we heard in large part through Franklin.
Yeah, he just gave him some diary entries, so he kind of got to write first person.
Yeah, like we got some access there. And, you know, Ezra Jennings and Rosanna both have, you know, a very sad end.
I would have liked to hear Gooseberry's story. That was the other detective that I was most impressed with, was Gooseberry.
Was
man,
so
that
good.
Kid was sharp. He was all over. Even Cuff was like, this kid has a great future.
Yeah, this kid, he would have been a welcome addition, I think, to any police force.
Yes, So, should have been a spinoff.
Yeah, and, you know, so Moonstone, right, it's, I think, 1668, and Sherlock Holmes is going to first appear in print in 1887. It's almost 20 years later. I mean, I think it's just obvious that Wilkie Collins influenced Arthur Conan Doyle and many other writers of the late 19th century and into the 20th century, just onward. I think there's so many interesting things that he does in The Moonstone and in The Woman in White. You know, just you have these idiosyncratic, super smart, you know, detective or inspector, like Inspector Cuff. And then also with the Detective Fever, all these other characters who are in their own way acting as detectives. I think that's so so interesting.
Yeah. I love your looking forward questions, but I always feel at a loss, like, because I can only look back. I don't have enough insight into Sherlock Holmes to be like, oh, yeah, clearly this influenced some. Yeah. I mean, I think I read Hound of the Baskervilles in school, and I'm super excited. Mm-hmm. I think we have two Sherlock Holmes books, right, coming up.
We do.
There's A Study in Scarlet and Hound of the Baskervilles.
And the Hound of the Baskervilles, yeah.
Yeah, so then I'll be able to look back and be like, oh, yeah, I see this. But for me, everything is like real retrospective. So I want to hear for you looking forward, like how do you see this influencing
Sherlock Holmes? So you have this Sherlock Holmes sort of outsider, you know, super, super smart, super interesting and, you know, strange. You have the bumbling cops, you have just a bunch of characters with extra, you know, these really amazing skills in observation, or in like a Sherlock Holmes, it's going to be one character in particular with that, but it's really quite distributed in The Moonstone. Red herrings, like you have a, in The Moonstone in part one, they're all in this house for this party. And so the culprit is probably in the house. So you have a small circle of suspects. Like there's a bunch of things done here in the book that many, many writers are going to borrow from. The secrecy and silence of Rosanna and of Rachel Verinder. They don't tell really important things. And if they did, it would have opened all kinds of doors way earlier. And so that secrecy and that like willingness to withhold key evidence, that's critical.
Interesting.
And we're going to see that in our next book that we're reading is The Mystery of a Hansom Cab. Tell us something about that.
So it was Australia's first literary sensation, published in 1886. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies worldwide. Set in the charming and deadly streets of Melbourne, this thriller highlights class and social issues as a crime is committed by an unknown assassin. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to our next book.
Our next book is The Mystery of a Hansom Cab. It's written by Fergus Hume. You can find it on Amazon. You can possibly find it at your local bookstore, which would be kind of fun.
It would be. I actually have started using eBay a lot since I noticed a lot of local bookstores put up these vintage copies, and I'm a super big fan. So I haven't found Hansom Cab on a vintage copy, but I did find this one, The Big Bow Mysteries, which kind of reprints old artwork and stuff like
that.
Which
is really fun. Gutenberg, I think gutenberg.org, also has online free versions of the books that we're reading.
Awesome.
So if you love online and you don't want to pay for the Kindle version, go to Project Gutenberg and get a online version to read. And because a couple of these books are, they're not difficult to get, but you got it with a couple of them, you've got to work at a little harder than if you were just trying to pick up the latest, you know, Harry Potter or something like that.
Well, from your description, and I haven't started it yet, The Mystery of a Hansom Cab sounds like maybe one of the most accessible books we've read so far.
It's short, too. So if you're looking for rewarding page-turner and short, this is the combo you're looking for. And it's got the bonus of taking place in Australia, which, how awesome is that? You know, so many of these books are going to take place in Britain or in England. And it's, I think, kind of fun to have a Melbourne story.
Definitely. Different flavor a little bit here.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to continuing the conversation with The Mystery of a Hansom Cab.
Yeah. Thank you, listeners. Let us know your thoughts.
Yeah. Share them with us at www.teatonicandtoxin.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Teatonic and Toxin.
Thanks.
Thank you.